Hi, this is Chelsea, and I'd like to start this episode in a bit of an unprecedented format. I'm most comfortable scripting things out and then reading them, as demonstrated by my spectacular skill at sounding awkward during interviews. But I'm just going to freeform this, so I'm sorry in advance. I haven't felt extremely confident with the trajectory of my series of interviews after the verdict wrapped in season one. I wasn't sure if for Wednesday scheduled interviews on top of four jury breaks would be a little bit like interview overload for my listeners. I don't want people to drop out or unsubscribe because they're not receiving the usual amount or ratio of scripted audio drama content. I also wanted to make sure I was delivering the right kind of content, the kind of content that was most interesting and relevant to all of you, and I hope I'm doing a good job. I've never done this before. As mentioned, this podcast was put together inside of my apartment, recorded inside of my apartment. The people that I've spoken to, I've found because they reached out to me on Facebook or Gmail. So I'm not an extraordinarily gifted journalist or any kind of journalist. And while I hope I'm doing a good job, I just want to let you know what to expect in future so that you can decide whether or not I'm nailing it. And if not, I'm open to suggestions for how best to suit your needs. First of all, I want to let you know that the second season of Deliberations, featuring a whole new trial, is launching in January. I'm really excited about it. I'm going to have more information about that coming up soon. In 2 days, I'm interviewing Michaela Fleming, and she is the actress who played Samantha Hall, and completely unbeknownst to me at the time that I cast her, she is extremely informed, well-versed, and personally connected to the lifestyle of BDSM, so much so that she's written her thesis on the subject, and that thesis is enriching and meaningful in ways that I could not have anticipated. And I highly suggest listening to that episode because it meant a lot to me being involved with it, listening to what she had to say. And I hope it means something to you too. After that interview, the following two Wednesdays, I'm releasing part one and part two of a group interview with the exceptional cast of the jury from season one. I'm getting us all together. We're all going to sit down one night and just reminisce, rehash. I have questions about how closely their opinions aligned with those of their characters, what it was like inside the deliberations room while we were recording, any inner conflict they had about the experience and what they felt since the podcast started airing and the public reaction to it. And in the meantime, I really want to continue with these jury breaks. People love Jessa Nicholson Getz, and I get it, because so do I. And everything that I've been seeing online is this tremendous show of support and enthusiasm for her viewpoints, and I want to keep delivering that as best I can. Lately, I've asked for people to reach out about any high-profile cases that they wanted Jessa to speak about, and I chose a case that was somewhat of a departure from this season. The reason I did that is because the person who requested it on Facebook had a personal connection to people involved in the case, or a person involved in the case. And I just want to show as much support for devoted listeners of this show as they've shown me. Someone else requested OJ and Casey Anthony, but I feel like that would take kind of a week to cover that well-trod ground and say everything we wanted to say on those subjects. While the episode you're about to hear is a departure from kink and BDSM and sex crimes, I think it's really important. It's an officer-related shooting. It's an interesting case. And if people are receptive to it, if you are receptive to it, let me know. And it's something that we could explore for a future season, an officer-involved shooting. On the next jury break, I would like to speak to Jessa about something that she has mentioned to me in the past I found fascinating, which is her involvement in cases where people have filed restraining orders based on violations of master-slave contracts in BDSM relationships. I cannot wait to ask her about the details of those experiences. And following that, her thoughts on the prospective sentencing hearing of Samantha Hall. In December, I'm going to be releasing a bonus episode at a date TBD that is Samantha Hall's sentencing hearing episode. So if you are only interested in the audio drama from this show, don't unsubscribe because it will be dropping. And until I get everything aligned, I can't give you an exact date on that. In the meantime, I really hope I'm doing a decent job getting the content that you like to you in a way that you like. I'm trying my hardest. As mentioned at the end of this interview, it's a learning experience for me, and I'm struggling with it every week, and I'm doing my best. So thank you for the tremendous show of support that I'm still seeing on social media. I hope I'm doing you justice. And on that note, I bring you the brilliant Jessa Nicholson Getz with an exciting announcement of her own at the end of this episode. Thank you. I've asked listeners to reach out with any case that they wanted you to speak about, and we got several requests on Facebook, including O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony, which was pretty funny because I understand you are a fanatic about the O.J. case and you know everything there is to know and you're very well-versed. And I would definitely consider myself a fanatic on the Casey Anthony case. My reluctance to explore those were that I thought maybe they were a little over-examined already. And also, we got a post in the Facebook group that seemed the most personal and important to me. So I'm just going to read that post now. It's about the death of Daniel Shaver. And a really sweet and devoted listener named Becky left the following message. I would love Jessa to weigh in on this case. The trial is actually going on as we speak. I'm typically pro-defendant, but I have a personal bias in this case. The victim is my friend's husband. From the word go, this case has been controversial, not only because a cop was involved, but also the cop's father is retired cop and lawyer. Decisions regarding body cam footage, evidence being excluded, I don't like it, but actually understand why, witness issues, etc., etc., etc. I could go on and on and on. It's a heartbreaking yet fascinating case. There's a lot of info out there, but I'm only going to link to the wiki page. The probable cause hearing is on YouTube. It's intense. Oh, and also Mark Garagos. By the way, Justin, am I saying that right? I've only seen it printed. Garagos?
I think it's Garagos, but he would know better than we would.
Okay, yeah. I see it written a lot, but I don't hear it spoken a lot. Garagos, I'll say Garagos, is the attorney for the widow, which is in and of itself interesting. And she links to the wiki page. For those who don't know Mark Garagos, the lawyer, he is he's represented Michael Jackson, Winona Ryder, Scott Peterson, Chris Brown, and he actually assisted the family of David Carradine in the aftermath of his accidental autoerotic death, which I thought was I didn't realize that, and anything about autoerotic death these days sort of catches my attention, so found that interesting. You can find Becky's post in the Facebook group deliberations room, and you can just look for the death of Daniel Shaver on Wikipedia, which is the site that she listed. So I'm just going to give a quick overview of the case before I dive in and start asking Jessa questions and sort of for her general thoughts and opinions. The victim's name is Daniel Shaver. The defendant's name is Philip Mitchell Brailsford, and he was an officer in Mesa, Arizona. Daniel Shaver was staying at the La Quinta Inn and Suites on January 18th, 2016. And he had an air rifle in the room. And at some point during the evening, a witness saw from outside of the building, saw this air rifle in the window and became alarmed and contacted authorities. So authorities arrived to the La Quinta and they start calling out the occupants of room 502. In addition to Daniel Shaver, the occupants of room 502 were a woman and a man, and I believe, I haven't done that much research into them. Jessa, do you know if that was, one of them was a coworker?
It sounds like they were people he met that as part of his work travel. Okay. So I don't think that they knew each other prior to that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that there was a woman and a man, and the woman said she met him less than an hour before his death.
Right, and maybe he knew the guy beforehand, right. I'm not sure.
Okay, but the two of them left the hotel room without incident. I believe the woman testified in court that they didn't hear the officer shouting in the hallway, but eventually someone called the room's telephone and they were told to leave. And the woman and the man that were not Daniel Shaver left and they were unharmed. And shortly thereafter, Daniel Shaver left the room and he was crawling on his hands and knees. He was unarmed. And he was wearing something like basketball shorts. So as he's crawling along the ground, as I understand it, his shorts were being somewhat pulled down against the ground, and he kept reaching to lift them up.
Right, I think they were like baggy.
Baggy, yeah. And I think it was maybe a reflex for him to pull his pants up. And the officer, Philip Brailsford, told him not to. His view is that it looked like he might have a gun. He was reaching down towards his pants, and Philip Brailsford, the officer, grew alarmed. And I understand that Daniel Shaver on the ground was saying, please don't shoot, please don't shoot. And he was very upset and said, you know, he was basically pleading for his life or pleading for the officers not to shoot. And when he reached down for his pants again, Philip Brailsford yelled, don't. And then he shot him five times and Daniel Shaver died. So that was on January 18th. On February 10th, 2016, Daniel Shaver's widow filed a wrongful death lawsuit. I think it was $30 or $35 million. Also, in February, an interesting note is that the online group Anonymous threatened to hack the Mesa Police Department because Daniel Shavers was one of two suspicious officer-involved shootings in Mesa that year, the other being a transgender woman with Asperger's who'd been threatening suicide. And Anonymous has already had problems with Mesa Police Department and threatened to hack their system. Then in March, he was charged... Philip Brailsford was charged with second-degree murder. And also in March, March 21st, Brailsford was terminated by the police. So that is the case in a nutshell. The officers all were wearing body cameras at the time. So the body cam footage... Here's something I thought was interesting. I wanted to ask you about this, Jessa. Both the defense and the prosecution filed a joint motion to have the body cam footage sealed. Why was it in the prosecution's interest to file a joint motion? Why did both sides want the body cam footage to be sealed? Because it seems like, I get why it's in the defense's interest to have footage wherein the victim is shot and possibly pleading and, you know, found to be unarmed. Like, why they wouldn't want that to be released to the public, but I didn't fully understand why the prosecution had a problem with it being released.
So there are a number of different things that could be going on there. First of all, generally speaking, evidence can't be overly played to a jury. Like, you can't emphasize one piece of evidence and show it to them or give it to them more than any other piece of evidence. So usually, you know, there are photos of a crime scene that go into evidence. The rules typically say that either all of the photographs go back to a jury room or none of them do, but they don't get to take four of them and not have the opportunity to review the rest of it. Similarly, at least in my state, and I'm pretty sure this is true in many other states, when there is video footage that is evidence in a case, it's typically played once or however many times it is actually played in its entirety during the trial. But the video is never sent back to the jury so that they can watch or manipulate the video. Okay. And again, the thinking there is to do so would emphasize one portion of the case over any other portion of the case. So I think that maybe part of what goes on there is when both sides know that there's something that people are going to be interested in their jury pool, which is the general public at that point in the decision-making process, would be interested in and would be likely to watch and rewatch and manipulate in terms of, you know, slowing it down or listening to it with the sound off, sound on, things like that, that there's an interest in protecting the jury panel from that taint and from having them do independent research on a case, because of course jury deliberations are supposed to be based solely on what's heard in the record and what's seen in a courtroom. Another reason that the prosecution will typically ask to seal things is if there's an ongoing investigation about that particular piece of evidence. So I've had lots of cases where search warrants have been sealed for some period of time because they don't want the press reporting on what was returned on that search warrant because they're still doing follow-up investigation. And, it's possible that at that point they were trying to collect other body cam footage. It's possible that there was some issue with the recording. It's my understanding that in this case, the widow wanted it to be released. And another very common reason that the prosecution would move to seal something is out of respect for the alleged victim. And obviously, you know, being killed is, this is going to be perhaps a strange way to say it, but an intimate thing. I mean, it's an incredibly personal, tragic, impactful thing to watch. It's also disturbing to watch and mm-hmm. traumatic. Mm-hmm. But I can see why the state wouldn't necessarily want to put a victim's family through having that accessible on YouTube.
That makes sense.
So there are a lot of different reasons that the prosecution might have an interest in keeping it. Now, if you want me to take a cynical view, yet another one could be that you know, they don't want their police force to be viewed negatively in the larger public. And that could be something else that's at play there, is that even though the prosecution is tasked with attempting to convict this particular former police officer, they don't want to expose perhaps bigger systemic problems in their force.
Right. And you have had the opportunity to review this body cam footage. Is that right?
I watched everything that was available online. I couldn't find the portion where shots were fired.
Yeah, I don't think that's been released yet.
Right.
If it will be. My understanding is that they have it sealed until either an acquittal or a conviction, or either an acquittal or the sentencing, at which point they would release the full video. But everything that I watched from the body cam footage was primarily just the officers in the hallway shouting instructions for the occupants to leave the room. What did you see in the body cam footage, and how'd you feel about it?
I'm going to try and do this as neutrally as possible.
Okay.
So probably some of my opinions are going to slip in here, but I'm going to do my best. So the first thing that I guess, let me back up to say, this is a group of officers who are going to a hotel with the sincere belief that there is someone with a weapon. And the reports of the people in the hot tub that saw this air rifle just said that it looked like it was just pointing outside. One of them sort of seemed to say, well, maybe it started to point at us. We couldn't really tell. We got out of the hot tub because it made us uncomfortable. So you've got a group of officers that are responding to something that at least at the time, they have a reasonable belief that there are firearms involved. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to require a certain level of care. It's also a pretty dangerous situation to be approaching a room where you can't see into with the idea that there might be an armed man in the room. So I understand why the number of officers that responded. I understand why they sort of start out talking about what the plan is. I understand why they would do that. And I understand why it would be a concern that when they're shouting, you know, police, you have to come out, et cetera, that there's no response. I can see how that would start to make the officers nervous. That because from my view, it's at least 10 minutes where they're identifying themselves as police and there's just no response. Right. And, you know, nobody knows what's happening behind that door at that point. So that's kind of how this whole thing starts, is this effort to get these people out of the room. And everything there makes total sense to me. I'm a little surprised that the officers are using rifles. And in fact, the defendant in this case was armed with a weapon that was not his standard issue police firearm, but was a personal firearm that he had clearance to use on the job if he so chose. And I thought that was kind of interesting. The initial debrief that he gave from reading the supplemental reports said that, you know, it was something that he thought was appropriate to use because it allows someone to shoot from further away. And he thought that that made sense because he might have to shoot not at close range and that was a gun that worked better for shooting from farther away. You know, do I think that 30 feet of a hallway is the farther away that requires a long gun? Not particularly, but I'm also not a firearms expert. So I would note, though, that he admitted that he didn't know what type of firearm the people occupying the hotel room were alleged to have had. So it wasn't as though he heard that they had a rifle and so he took a rifle. It was just a choice based on his assessment of the potential threat.
Right.
So that's what you've got first. Then there's some commotion, you know, where there's different kind of screaming at the door. Things appear to escalate just in terms of impatience more than anything else, I think. I read some investigator report where there was a discussion of like being able to hear a loud noise that some people reported could have been consistent with gunshots. I could not hear that on the version that I watched. So I didn't hear any startling noise or anything like that. But then what happens next is it cuts to where obviously Daniel Shaver has already been shot. Right. So that's what I was able to review. I would tell you my review of that doesn't give me a lot of information in determining the reasonableness of use of force because the meat of this, so to speak, has been edited out. So we can't watch exactly what happened while it was happening.
Have you ever been involved in a case with body cam footage?
So we had an officer-related shooting here a couple of years ago in Madison. Tony Robinson was the name of the young man who was killed. And they released body cam footage of that incident. And so that was not my case. But obviously, having it happen locally, we were very interested in it and very interested in what our district attorney's office was going to do about charging it. So I've watched that. I don't think, no, you know what? I had a really low level case now that I'm thinking about it, just a disorderly conduct resisting arrest that there was body cam footage that was helpful. Most of the time when I get video footage, it's either surveillance or squad. Our officers locally are just starting to get the body cams. Mm-hmm. So not every precinct that we have in terms of our little municipalities have that yet.
Got it. So you said that was sort of your assessment, given with the most unbiased perspective as possible. Do you have any defense attorney bias that you want to share about anything to do with the body cam footage?
Well, okay. So maybe I don't have complete facts. So everyone should take that idea with a grain of salt. My ideas with a grain of salt.
Okay.
But they obviously knew how to call into this room and ask the occupants to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm unclear from an escalation standpoint why you wouldn't try that first. And I couldn't find anything that happened to suggest that that was something that the police tried first. And when you send police officers in anywhere, and I want to say I have a ton of respect for how scary that job is. I really do.
Yeah.
And I've tried self-defense homicides, and I've talked to people who have committed a homicide when they really believed their life was in danger. And that's touching to me. And so I do hear that, and I respect the job that people do. I also know that anytime police have to execute an arrest warrant or they have to go in search in hot pursuit of a suspect, anytime they're entering unknown territory, private territory, with people, with actors that they're not sure of their intentions, which would be this case, that's considered a higher risk situation than being able to do things in public places, than voluntary surrenders, than conversations. And so whether it's consistent with what the Mesa police procedure is or not, it would seem to me that making any effort whatsoever, including just dialing the phone, to avoid having to put your officers in that position in the first place would have been worth trying.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm a little critical that everybody decided to go in guns blazing. The counter argument to that is, what if this guy had a firearm and was holding hostages in the hotel room? And they don't know the answer when they get that call.
Yeah, but even if that was the case, you would think that they might have placed a phone call to the room earlier or at first.
I don't think that they lose a critical amount of time in having one officer hang back and place a phone call, even while the other ones get into position. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that I saw about that footage that tells me time was so much of the essence that had to be done exactly the moment that it was.
Right. Right. And like you said, there's a lot we don't know. Like personally, I'm confused about why the occupants of room 502 were unable to hear the officers. If they were right outside in the hallway yelling that loudly, it seems like, I don't know if they had music playing. I didn't hear any in the footage, but for whatever reason, they were unable to hear. So maybe the officers didn't anticipate that being an issue either. So who knows?
Right. And to be honest, I reacted adversely to the fact that there was no response, because it seemed to me from watching the footage that anyone would have been able to hear the police. Mm-hmm. Now, flip side to that, you didn't see any other doors open on that floor. And if somebody is yelling, stop police, I think it's reasonable to expect that someone would open the door to see what was going on. So maybe it wasn't as loud as we think it is from watching the body cam. I'd like to hear, you know, if there were people in the adjoining rooms, if they could hear it. I don't know the answer to that.
Right. Well, actually, it's interesting you say that, because I just assumed that the officers had quietly evacuated the other rooms in the vicinity in advance of the footage that we saw. And since we don't have that advanced footage, we can't know exactly.
Right. See, and I didn't assume that, but I have to tell you, if they had the time to quietly evacuate an entire floor of a hotel, they definitely had the time to pick up the phone and make a call in an attempt to do this without escalation.
Yeah, it's a bit confusing. And for the record, I forgot to mention this, but for listeners, the reason he had an air rifle is because Daniel Shaver was in pest control, and so he used that air rifle as a part of his job. And I think he might have actually had two in the room with him on that night.
That was what I read, is that there was more than one, but there was only one that people reported seeing.
Right, right. But in case anyone's curious as to why someone would have an air rifle in a hotel room, it was work-related. Not that he was using it for pest control on this evening, but it's why they were in his possession.
And so far as I understand, and I just want to, you know, this is, some of the stuff is speculative on my part, but I'm making what I hope are educated guesses. Number one, they would have known who the room occupant was. They would have had the opportunity because they obviously knew which room they were going to. So they would have had the ability to check with the front desk and find out who that person was that was the room occupant. They wouldn't know who else was in the room because, if, you know, if they're not on the, I was going to say rental agreement, but the hotel agreement, then that doesn't give you any clue. But let's assume that Daniel Shaver was the one that signed up for his own room, so his name would be on it. The police would have then had access to run his name through their database to see what information, at least in their state, came up. Now, I know he was traveling from out of state, so you don't know about what potential out of state convictions there are. But I think that if they had run his name, I haven't seen anything that suggests he had a criminal record. So that's data they potentially would have had while making this decision. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, but I think it's a reasonable thing to think they could have obtained.
Right. Yeah.
And that matters to me because if your job is to assess the dangerousness of a situation, then I think it's useful to know as much as you can about the individuals in the situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. The second legal issue that I wanted to ask you about is some excluded evidence. So you mentioned that the defendant's rifle was a personally owned rifle and he had clearance to use it at work. The rifle had a dust cover on it. This is my understanding, is there was a dust cover with the words engraved in it, "You're fucked." And it was an AR-15 patrol rifle, in case people are familiar with what that is. I'm not personally, but in case it's relevant. So the judge said that this dust rifle with the words "you're fucked" was totally prejudicial and it's been excluded from evidence. And the prosecution argued that the dust cover gave insight into Brailsford's state of mind at the time of the shooting. So what are your thoughts on this decision to exclude this evidence?
So, all right. And actually, I think, Chelsea, that there was an engraving on, there was the "you're fucked" engraving, and then I think there was something written in like Latin that translated to some equal, you know, like "bite the dust" or some similar idea that was on the, in or stitched into the holster or the cover or something. So I actually saw two different things that were subject to this ruling. So here's what I'll tell you about this. I don't buy the prosecution's argument that it goes to his state of mind at the time of this alleged offense. We don't know if he was the one that actually had that engraving or embossment done. That gun could, you know, that could have been a gift. Someone else could have thought that was funny or an inside joke between, you know, partners in law or crime or police, LEO stuff. There we go. You know, so, I mean, it doesn't temporally track for me. We, you know, it'd be one thing if there was evidence that he shouted "you're fucked" at Daniel Shaver. That, I think, would be pretty good evidence. But just the existence of that, I would make an analogy of that to tattoos. You know, I mean, I have the right to counsel clause and the confrontation clause in the Sixth Amendment tattooed on my back. I got it for my 30th birthday. Thanks. It doesn't, but it tells you something about me as a person. You know, that obviously that was important enough to me that I chose to put it on my body permanently. And I think that to a lesser extent than a tattoo, what you engrave on jewelry or weaponry, if that's your thing, or whatever, does tell you something about someone as a person. And I think that this "you're fucked" does give you some character insight on this guy. You know, I hear that and I make assumptions about him. I assume that he's probably a little brash. I assume he might be a little cocky, arrogant. He probably has a strong sense of what he believes is right and wrong. I think that you could argue that it is intended to be darkly humored. I think that if you take it seriously, it could indicate some vigilante type tendencies in someone. And all of this, which I've just recited, is probably inadmissible character evidence. And so, you know, having done that exercise, I have to say I agree with the judge's ruling that by hearing that information, I do draw conclusions about the defendant and his character. And as we've talked about many times in our interviews, that's not what a trial's supposed to be about.
Right. Yeah, I can't say that that was an unfair ruling or that it even occurred to me that it was unfair or wrong in some way. But I have seen a lot reported about the dust cover, which might speak to just sort of public interest about anything that seems a little sensational. You know, that's a pretty inflammatory remark to be involved in an officer involved shooting in any way. So I can understand.
Right. That. I mean, I do think it lets you draw conclusions, and I don't think those are conclusions that are positive for this defendant.
Right. So the trial is ongoing. I'm going to be following it just because now I've researched it and I'm pretty curious about it. If I had to ask what your prediction for this trial would be, what do you think will happen?
So I'm going to answer that in a long-winded way.
Let's go.
Yeah. So first I want to tell you what I think are going to be the crucial issues, okay, because I've given that a lot of thought. Number one, this is a topic that has really come to a head in our country in the past few years. Police shootings, overreaching of police use of force, whether or not it makes sense to have our police forces trained to escalate and trained to shoot, essentially the old shoot first, ask questions later adage, that's been an ongoing topic of conversation. The Black Lives Matter movement has really helped publicize some of the very real complaints that people have about police officer involved shootings. So I think the issue is a political issue, which always makes for a slightly different bent on a trial. When trials are free of sort of the bigger politic, I think that it tends to be a cleaner trial, mm-hmm, because you don't have jurors going in with strongly held opinions. And this was likely a pretty divisive jury selection because people come down really strongly on police use of force. I think that that's something that is commonly being talked about right now. This one's a little different because, and I'm going to talk about this frankly because it's my belief that we need to talk about stuff like this frankly. This defendant appears to be, this victim is, he was a good-looking white guy. And there's all sorts of data that talks about the racial disparities in the way that we view violent crime. And you can see it in all sorts of death penalty stats that you are more likely to die if you are a black man who kills a white woman than you are in any other circumstance. You are always more likely to get the death penalty if you kill white people versus not white people. And in the wake of all of these police shootings that we've seen, you know, I can't even name them all, but starting, I mean, it's been going on for years now. One of the sadly common and sadly tragic things has been that young African-American men are typically the victims. And I understand why people look at it and say, gosh, juries are just not reacting and district attorney's offices just aren't charging these. And it feels like there's a racial issue there.
Right.
I understand people's perspectives. Obviously, you hope that's not true, but I think it would be really naive to say that, you know, the race of the victim here and his young age and the fact that he was working and he's got an attractive widow who, you know, he's got adorable children. You know, all of that is politicized. And I don't think that we can talk about this case without acknowledging that reality. And I know that's not comfortable, But so I think that that actually tilts things a little more pro-prosecution than we've seen it do in some of the police officer involved shootings, unfortunately. And I mean, this just makes me sick to say, but then we see with people in non-white racial groups.
Right.
So that's one thing. The second thing that I think is a really important factor is what the other officers are saying. And I tried to find as much as I could about that. One did testify and I was able to look at parts of that. And then, like I said, I read the supplemental investigative reports. And it seems to me that the officers are pretty lukewarm on support here. What you had was you had this guy, Sergeant Langley, who's just screaming right before this shooting happens about, if you put your hands on your back again, we're going to shoot you. He really was quite aggressive, yelling like, don't move. Listen to what I have to say. You need to cooperate. Move again and you'll be dead. Okay, so that was happening from this sergeant that was not the defendant in the case. But then that sergeant, despite these movements, didn't fire shots. And the officers in the defendant's immediate vicinity didn't fire shots. So nobody else, the question when you talk about if it's a justified shooting or a good shot, is would a person in the defendant's position reasonably believe that their life was in danger? And I would suggest that it's pretty strong evidence for the prosecution that nobody else that was standing in that hallway had the same reaction. So that really makes me question if that reaction is reasonable. Now, the officers also do try and toe the party line a little bit by saying it looked like he could have been reaching for a weapon. It also looked like he could have been pulling his pants up. The victim here was in a very passive position. I mean, the way that his body ultimately fell was in a quasi-fetal position. He was on his knees when he was shot. The shots are back to front. And that, when you've got a highly dynamic crime scene where, people are shooting back and forth and they are running, people start to turn and run, you can sometimes see shots to the back that, if you slow footage down and watch use of force analysis, you can see how somebody still would have appeared to be moving forward. But then their body spins along with the bullet. And so you end up with an entry wound on the side or the back of a body, even though when the shot was fired, the person might have been advancing forward. That's clearly not the case here. I mean, this man was on his hands and knees. So I saw that the original statement the defendant gave was that he perceived the movement on the hands and knees, the crawling forward, to be an aggressive posture because Mr. Shaver was coming towards him. However, other officers do say that he was instructed to crawl forward. So that's an inconsistency that I think is a really relevant one too. Because I'm not sure you can sell me on the idea that you, defendant, believed his posture to be aggressive if one of your coworkers just gave that specific instruction.
Right.
So that, what the other officers say they saw and how they reacted, or rather, their lack of reaction. And in fact, I read that one officer shouted, "No, don't do it," or something to that effect, that there was at least one person, and I think it was actually that Sergeant Langley, who had been so kind of aggro about trying to get these people out of this hotel room in the first place, and, very threatening and intimidating, while he's giving instructions about get down on the ground, ultimately was the one that spoke out and said, no, don't shoot. And so his testimony, I don't think it's happened yet because I couldn't find anything online about it, but I'd be really interested to see how he testifies, because that's going to be important evidence to me.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how the case turns out, because like you said, as most officer-involved shootings involve Black victims, and this is a white victim. If this is a case in which the officer is found guilty, then I think that there would be a lot of racial conclusions drawn. So,
yeah, I do too. And, you know, that there's tension there. And there are, and I'll say this, so that those are kind of, I think I sort of made arguments there that probably sounded pretty pro-prosecution. Couple of things that are perhaps pro-defense. Number one, people generally trust the police. Only people who have really had contact with the criminal justice system that's been negative, people that read a lot about, you know, some of the ways that law enforcement has handled or mishandled things in the past. There are, and then certainly there are subcultures that have just had really negative, racist, biased police response throughout their entire lives. But a lot of people, a lot of your people that you pull from corners of Mesa, Arizona, probably tend to start out by at least thinking police officers are as credible as the rest of us, if not more so. And it's powerful testimony to hear from anyone that they were terrified and that they feared for their life. And I'm sure that this officer, former officer, is going to testify in his own defense, because I don't know how you argue justified homicide or, you know, self-defense or defense of others without telling your own story. That would be, in my view, a very bad move from the defense to rest without calling him. But people, I think, listen to that narrative. They listen to the narrative of self-defense. And a lot of people give police the benefit of the doubt. I mean, we just, you know, there was just an acquittal where, in, you know, the Castile case, where there was a Facebook Live video that was pretty awful to watch. And I watched that and thought, there's no way this guy's going to be acquitted. I mean, there's just no way. And he was. And part of that is that somebody in, you know, in blue shows up with a badge and raises their hand and says, yeah, I thought they were going to come for me if I didn't take care of it. People give that a lot of weight. And, you know, maybe we as a society should talk about the presumptions of credibility that we give the police, because I don't know that those are always founded in reality. I don't know that they're always fair. So I would say that. I would also tell you that I think I expect that a big part of the defense argument will be that I think it was definitely over 10 minutes. It might have been as long as 17 minutes that the police were attempting to get these people out of this room and there was no response, because the whole time that clock is ticking, I think it's reasonable for an officer to be thinking, God, what if they're loading their firearms? What if they're getting ready? You know, I mean, what's going on there? And that unknown, with the prior knowledge that there is a report of a firearm being in the room, does present as a valid threat. It really does. I understand why that is taken seriously. I think you have to take that seriously. So those are kind of the things that I expect the defense to hammer in on. It is interesting to, you know, and maybe this is part of those, you know, the injustice of the racial dynamics in the criminal justice system. But it is really interesting to see how positively commenters talk about this victim compared to the way that some of the coverage of other victims of police shootings has been. You know, and maybe it's that this particular individual doesn't have a criminal history and some of the other people that have been shot in recent years did. But there isn't this sort of backlash discussion of, oh yeah, look, he's a thug, that we see in so many of these, and that I just find to be so unfair. So I think that, so sadly, you know, who Daniel Shaver looks to be may be a big factor in this case, whether or not it's reflective of, you know, who he actually was or who the officer actually is.
Yeah. I agree. Like, I understand all of that, and I'm really interested to see how it plays out.
Yeah, these are tough cases. I you know, it's hard to, it's hard to watch, and it's hard to think about when you hear the description of him on his hands and knees. I struggle, and this is me as a person, not me as a lawyer. I struggle with understanding how you put a bullet in someone's head who's on their knees. Mm-hmm. But, you know, because that to me, when I hear that fact description, I think of like mob executions. I don't think of justifiable shootings. So we'll see. You know, the furtive gesture, and that's all over the supplemental language. Oh, he made a furtive gesture. I can tell you, I think that phrase is just total police bullshit. I don't believe in the furtive gesture. I think it's just that a person moves. Anything can be construed as a furtive gesture. And so I'm not buying that at all. But I would want to hear, you know, I haven't at this point heard the defendant's side of the story. And I think it's important to give him the opportunity to tell that story. While I wouldn't hold his decision not to testify against him, I would hold it against his lawyer, because I think that would be really bad legal strategy.
Right.
Because I think he's got to get up and explain what he was feeling.
Yeah. Speaking of tough legal strategies and the mind of legal experts, if you are not prepared to make this announcement or talk about it now, I fully understand. But do you have anything that you'd like to announce to our listeners yet? Or would you?
I do.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I do. So, but with the caveat that this is still like the beta testing phase.
Okay, noted. So noted.
So, thanks for letting me. A few people had kind of reached out to me and suggested that if I were to do a podcast of my own, people would like to hear that. I still don't understand why, but you don't have to encourage me to talk more very often. Really, any opportunity you give me to talk more, I will just do that. And so because of that, and because I spend so much of my time doing exactly this, my business partner, one of my business partners, Nick Gansner, and I have started a little podcast. And we're calling it Getting Off, and we've got social media up. Getting Off is a pun on both, oh, that guy got off, and the fact that we're sex crimes attorneys. And so we did that on purpose. It was cute. I posted something to your guys' Facebook page, and someone was like, I think that name might be a little furry. We're like, yeah. So here's the situation on how to follow it. And if you don't mind, I want to just give a brief synopsis of what the plan is with it,
because we're still.
So you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Getting Off Pod. It's the same handle everywhere. There's also a Facebook group for discussion, which is the Getting Off Podcast discussion group. And our email address is also gettingoffpod@gmail.com. We recorded an introduction, like just a little trailer that we posted yesterday, and we put up our first full-length episode this morning. And in that episode, we sort of explain our ongoing vision for this podcast. So what we're going to do is alternate between talking about larger scale issues in the criminal justice system. So things like sentencing reform and bail reform and evidentiary issues, how mental health is used to mitigate or aggravate sentences, things like that. Basically, whatever we feel like or whatever you guys want to hear about. And then the next episodes, those policy episodes will typically be a springboard into the trial tracking episodes, where then Nick and I, and you'll hear that Nick is a former prosecutor before I recruited him to come over to the dark side here. We are going to start with the crime itself, the alleged crime itself, go through the arrest, the pretrial motions, the evidentiary rulings, the trial testimony and evidentiary rulings in trial, and the impact of the acquittal, if there is an acquittal, and the impact of the conviction and the sentencing and any issues that go around with that if there's a conviction. So that's going to be kind of the deep dive portion of it. We're going to alternate back and forth. We have chosen our first case. I'll tell you guys too. We did tell you on the first little thing we launched, but we're going to do Brock Turner first.
Yes.
So that's where we're going to start. And I think our episode 3, which will air next week, is going to be Nick playing prosecutor and me playing defense attorney. And that we'll go through the facts around that and then talk about some of the, you know, the things that happened at the sentencing hearing and the larger societal implications afterwards. So what we're looking for is if there are cases that you guys are interested in or that caught your attention, email us, tweet at us, Instagram at us, communicate in some way, and we'll start looking at them. We're learning, okay? And I think of, I'm a huge Aaron Sorkin fan, and The West Wing is like my all-time favorite television show. And there's this scene where one of the characters is learning to make balloon animals, of all things. And Josh Lyman asks, is that abstract? And she says, I'm a beginner. And that's what I just want to stress is we're learning editing software. We have enlisted the assistance of someone who knows how to do that. So hopefully starting in episode 3, our audio will be cleaner than it is the first 2. But we'd love it if you'd tag along.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. First of all, I'm still learning podcasting too.
That makes me feel good because yours sounds so good.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I really appreciate the compliment. It's this entire thing is still a big learning curve for me. So welcome to the club. Also, I'm so excited by the concept of this podcast. I could listen to you for days. You are so informed and you're so enthusiastic and you're so your presentation is really, really engaging. Plus, I was fully transfixed by the Brock Turner stuff at the sentencing hearing. That's when I first became aware of the case. And I was really, really interested. And I digested a lot of the information that came out at that time. So I would love to hear a deeper dive from you guys on that case. I think it's a really strong choice for the first episode. And I want listeners to tune in as much as possible because that's what I'm going to be doing. And I'm looking forward to geeking out over this really hard.
Oh my God, and you are so sweet, because let me just say, while we're having mutual admiration, I just think your writing is top notch. I actually re-listened to part of the scripted portions of deliberations, and I just have to say that again. I mean, it's nuanced and it's thoughtful and it's well-researched, and I love it. So we clearly love each other. That's happening. That's happening,
thank
guys.
You.
And I, just because we're trying this little experiment, I hope that doesn't mean that you and I can't continue to talk, because I love doing these.
That makes me really happy. I would love to continue talking with you. If you have the time before you become a big pod star, then I'm going to exploit you as often as I can.
Awesome. So thank you so much for letting us shout it out. And
absolutely. You're going to be shouting it out more. Every time you're on the show, I want you to shout it out. And I'm also going to be posting stuff to your content on all of my social channels. And I'm really excited to get this going.
And we will do the same for you.
Oh,
I don't want to brag, but I think we have like 18 Instagram followers now.
Whoa.
Slow it down. And I think 7 of them are the members of my office.
Oh my God, honey, we're in the same boat. I actually have an Instagram for deliberations and I never talk about it because I never post on it because I'm not very Instagram intuitive. I'm not intuitive. And so it's really sad. I think I have like a couple dozen followers on there too. For the record, listeners, if you want to follow me on Instagram, I promise I'll make more of an effort. And that's at Deliberation Pod.
Awesome. Chelsea, if I could say one thing, just briefly, I'm sorry about this, but I wanted to. I listened to the last episode and I wanted to talk about the email from the press.
Great. Yeah.
Just really briefly,
please.
Which was, I just wanted to say that number one, the person that wrote that email was obviously thoughtful and had a firm commitment to the integrity of their job. And I respected it immensely. Number two, I absolutely agree that the press is a part of an adversarial system in that it is their job to provide information to make citizens more informed. And part of what citizens need to be informed about are issues of criminal justice. I don't dispute that at all. I completely accept and agree that open trials and open court is vital to the protection of American freedom. And none of my critiques about what I would refer to as less concerned and less ethical journalism should apply to people that view their work and the work that they do in the way that I could tell that person did. I would, however, say, I would, however, say, and you can cut this whole thing if you want to, you don't have to use it, but I would say that I don't necessarily agree that when I see crime news reporting, that it's really an effort to blend conflicting information to reach truth. I agreed with the statement that it was, that they try and tell it in a compelling way. Mm-hmm. But I bump on the use of the word truth, like with a capital T, because part of what being a defense attorney is speaking truth to power, not just in the sense that we're standing up, you know, against the system, but also that powerful people, including prosecutors, including the police, tend to think that they have a monopoly on defining truth. And that their narrative is the only truthful narrative. And through the work of creative, committed defense attorneys, we let people's truths show through that aren't described by the people in power. And I think that it's a dangerous thing to say, oh, we blend two inconsistent stories to find one truth, because I don't necessarily agree that there always is one truth when it comes to the nuanced and complicated issues in the criminal justice system. And so I do bump on the idea that what's printed in the press is taken as absolute truth.
Right.
So that is just, you know, and it's not that people don't intend to be accurate, but I do question when you've got the people in power releasing information first. So the government, with all of their resources, having the first crack at what gets delivered to the press, that's not an equal power structure between the prosecution and the defense. And it's not that there are two competing ideas that are given equal time. It's that the people in power define their truth first, and that truth is reported. And then we're often left to wait until the trial to get to try and tell ours.
Right. Yeah, no, I followed all of that. I think I don't know what the answer is, like, because the tenets that you outlined in your episode about the press, about how the media's first access to information is like the prosecution standpoint, and you know, the press is typically on deadline and trying to release news stories as quickly as they can. And all of that makes sense. And it doesn't really equate to the most unbiased presentation of information for journalists to curate and disseminate. So I'm not sure what the answer is. Like, I almost wish there was a more unbiased protocol for getting information to the press.
Early.
Yeah, right. Early. And like what the press has access to at what stage. I don't know if anything that I'm suggesting bumps up against censorship. I don't know. But I think that these are really interesting questions, and I'm glad that we're asking them, and I'm really glad we're exploring them. And I fully understand your point of view.
Yeah, you know, so it's, and that's not to say that people are, because, you know, the person said, well, there's a difference between bad reporting and reporting you don't like. And the comment was lawyers are spin doctors to a certain extent, and that we are advocates. Yes, we are. We are advocating for a position. That's absolutely true. And I think that I should be asked every tough question anyone will ever ask me about my position, because I should be able to defend it and defend it articulately and ardently, and I'll go all day. I just want to be asked the questions. Mm-hmm. And when I speak about the frustration I have, it's that I'm either not asked them, or my ethical restraints, because there are rules about what we say to the press, prevent me from being able to give complete answers. And so that then presents an incomplete picture. So I just wanted to share those thoughts.
I'm really glad that you listening. Did. No, thank you. I'm really glad you did. And sorry, I actually meant to broach that subject with you again and completely escape my mind with all of the Daniel Shaver discussions. But I'm glad that we're touching on that, because it's a really important topic, and it's important that you have a chance to address any concerns that people have. And I will say again, like, that was an abridged version of the email I read, but the writer of that email was a fan of yours and totally respected your profession. And again, I see how journalists and defense attorneys are up, you know, you guys face a lot of heat, both of you, for different reasons.
Oh, no. And we totally do. And I respect the hell out of journalists because, you know, they're doing such a fundamentally important thing for our society. And especially right now, like you said, they've come under fire. And I do believe a lot of that criticism is unwarranted. A lot of it. You know, I think there might be these little like local people that breach ethics, but there are a lot, the majority of people in the profession, I definitely think are earnest and genuinely care about what they're doing and are committed to all of those ideas that are espoused. And
yeah, I agree. And I think there's a big difference between heat that journalists are facing from, say, the White House right now, rather than rather than your kind of like really informed arguments about the way press coverage relates to like criminal trials and your experience within that and sort of, you know, a lot of objectionable protocols that are in place. So not the same thing.
Right. Agreed. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me back.
Thank you so much, Jessa. Again, always a pleasure. You're such a fan favorite. I'm completely stoked about getting off. And I'm going to be your most steadfast listener.
And you're awesome.
We always are. You're correct.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Have a great day. I'll see you later or talk to you later. Too. Okay.
All right.
Bye. Thanks again to Jessa for today's interview. And again, please stay tuned this Wednesday when our real life Samantha Hall speaks about her personal connection to the character, which is a lot stronger than any of us would have guessed. Have a great 2 days.